Happy Darwin Day. Where are the pencils at?
Yep.
Indeed. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. Coming at you from Tacoma, Washington. Joining me today is Ron. John, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, Sam.
Fantastic. And how are you, Dan?
I'm great. Not so sure this isn't a satire show anymore.
No, I guess not. Yeah, I don't even know how to do an open for something like this. Okay, you know what? Let's start out with something not satire. Let's talk about something cool. Today is Darwin Day.
Today Yay! Is Darwin Day.
Today, in fact, is Darwin Day. And it's like an official big day thing here in Washington State.
Yep.
Thanks to somebody who sat at this desk last week.
I know, but it takes a long time to get something like that done, but yeah. It's gradual change we can all believe in.
Yes! Oh, I just got goosebumps.
Yeah, last week was a show I had for the first time since 2011.
Right.
I had no input in on whatsoever. I didn't do any writing. I did no hosting. I wasn't a guest.
It was Ask an Atheist near Sam Mulvey.
Yeah, no. It was originally supposed... I was originally supposed to be in the other room just pretending it wasn't happening. But instead...
Typical Sunday afternoon.
Right. But instead, I ended up in Richland, Washington with Jeremy Whitman. Where he was doing comedy for 3 days. And it was just, I thought I was just going out with him to do a show for a night. He's like, oh, it's like a 3-day thing, and there's like a hotel. And I'm like,
Oh. I'm trapped in Richland.
Hey, man. Snow's nice. And then, yeah, came back and got some new 3D printed teeth. I have technology mouth.
Yay!
Your
interview with Ernst Stavro Blofeld is next week?
He's only part replicant.
No, I totally failed Voigtkamp. Anyway, we should probably get to the news. So this is a big show this week, a lot going on. But in this segment, for this half hour, we're going to be talking about news specifically of import to the atheism community directly. Ramon Kasha, chairperson of the Malta Humanist Association, died on January 27th due to complications from a motorcycle accident last summer. During his life, he advocated for and witnessed the introduction of same-sex civil unions, emergency contraception, and the freedom to divorce. Divorce, which was only granted to the Maltese in 2011 by popular referendum. Commenters on Maltese news websites described him as a frequent commenter who earned respect from his online opponents. Ooh. So I don't, you know, like Malta is apparently something we talk about now on Ask an Atheist. Because from like last, we talked about the Knights of Malta, which granted have nothing to do with Malta itself, but here's, well, at least anymore, not since like, what, the 700s? I don't like remember the history there. But now we're talking about somebody actually in Malta itself, who is a humanist leader who, hey, got divorced in Malta in 2011.
Right.
Because remember, the 21st century is a magical century where we're all supposed to be, you know, Star Trek people.
Well, there is this sort of long tail of like sort of civilization. And so I think in the United States, we don't always recognize. I mean, we recognize it in sort of like shock value. Like whenever the national education standards come out, somebody's we're going to be compared to some country, and whatever country it is, it's always going to be a country like that we pick for shock value. Did you know that our students aren't even as good as the students in? And then in some country that we all have a mental model about that's basically like a bunch of people in wagons.
Right.
Right. The Ukraine, sorry, you're not allowed to say the Ukraine. That's not the thing anymore.
I missed that memo.
So yeah, it's Ukraine. The Ukraine is a region, and you call it the Ukraine when you're trying to identify it as a part of Russia.
Oh.
You call it Ukraine when you're identifying it as a country, i.e. not Russia.
Because there are other nations that like the definite article.
The.
Yeah.
Right.
There is one specifically that I can't remember right now, but it's in Africa somewhere.
The Africa?
People's Democratic Republic of the Congo?
Well, there's that. Yeah, there's stuff like that. Not the Africa. Yeah. Yes, Ron, John,
Africa.
Thank you.
Hey, there are other countries in Africa like the such as.
No, they had a...
Wow.
Ron John going internet deep.
Woo. Deep cuts today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, so they had a presidential crisis, and it's like the Gambia or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. I don't know why is it the there, but so I always figured it was just like that with the Ukraine, but now I know.
Yeah. There's and it's literally just that it's a political distinction.
Yeah.
Among the folks that actually drove the independence movement and the post-Cold War movement.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And now I know.
Say for the Ohio State University.
Right. Or the University of Ohio, Miami. Or, no, the University of Miami, Ohio.
Right.
What?
Yeah, there's an entire set of University of Miamis, none of which are in Miami, in the United States.
Well, that has to do with how we keep shipping people around when they're not the United States citizens, which we'll talk about in the later segments. but, yeah.
That said, so getting back to the story.
Right.
I think we don't... It's interesting to be able to connect via media, via news, and just sort of via the interconnectedness of leadership across countries through organizations like the UN,
right.
or organizations like the IPCC, where there are organizations that basically allow leaders across countries to connect with each other and establish kind of a common understanding of what's the end goal or what's good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally we see blips of this when we see a country like Malta that we have like a mental model of as sort of like being behind or being somewhere.
Right.
And then, you know, and it's like, oh, but, you know, they're still pushing on the same buttons that we're pushing on about same-sex marriage.
Sure.
They're still pushing on the same buttons around the definition of marriage and the rights of individuals and the rights of people to make decisions about their personal lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really excited to hear about this, that this is the kind of movement that's happening. It's sad, obviously, that this guy died.
Right.
But it's good to know that there's a movement there, and it's good to know that he was such a powerful figure in moving it forward.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of nice when you have conversations with people online and then you die and they're like, well, you know, they don't say, well, he was a chud. They say,
right.
You know, they say, well, he was good at what he did,
mm-hmm.
and managed to do these very positive things. I think that's really cool.
Right.
Would we have the same thing over here?
Right. I also personally take a moment to like remember that I am also a motorcyclist.
I was wondering because you
yeah.
probably read that story.
I read that this morning.
Yeah.
I was reading the notes and I was just like, oh. Yeah, I'll ride here a touch slower.
Gee.
Also, I'll put down this story while I'm riding.
Right. So. I'm not going to read the show notes while I'm riding my motorcycle down I-5.
If it could happen to Malta, it could happen to you.
Yeah,
exactly.
The HOV lane is not a good place for pre-show. I'll just put
I only read show notes in the slug lane.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Fair. All right, I got to say it because it's been killing me for 3 weeks. We're not talking about Malta. Every time we talk about Malta, I have to not think of Guccio. I have to not think of Joe Don Baker and that one episode of Mystery Science Theater, which is important to me because it was the first episode of Mystery Science Theater I ever watched with Becky, and our anniversary is coming up next week. So no. But yeah, I can't imagine. There's got to be like 10 or 20 people screaming at their podcasters going, why aren't you mentioning that episode of Mystery Science Theater? There, I've done it. The tension is released. We can move on.
The readers of Horse and Hound, thank you.
A group of Kenyan atheists have requested that their government consider declaring February 17th as a public holiday celebrating and recognizing atheists. Harrison Mumia, chair of the group Atheists in Kenya, explained that the date is the anniversary of the group's incorporation and advocates celebrating atheism because it prevents people from being ripped off by religious charlatans and frees up time that would otherwise be wasted in worship. Interior Minister Joseph Nkasiri, whose office allows him to establish celebrations under the Public Holidays Act, has not yet given an official response.
I love their statement. They're cutting right to the point. That's bold. That's
yeah,
bold.
Right.
I don't know a lot about the politics of Kenya itself.
Right.
But I know a lot of the surrounding nations are, not so friendly to that sort of dissent.
Yeah.
Well, and I like that they're making a time argument.
They are.
Like, yeah. That's actually kind of interesting. It's just like, let's just cut to the chase.
Yeah.
We really need, we have massive problems. There are things that need to be solved. And the smartest, most capable people in terms of organizing people to get together and do something are organizing them to get up early in the morning and sing songs. This is not the time we need to be, this is not what we need to be using with that skill.
There are clearly delineated process reasons why all of this is a bad idea. you know, it's one of those where I don't really have a lot of commentary on this one because it's just a really cool thing that I want to share that I read when, you know, on my news trawling that I wanted to share with people. And then, yeah, I read this time just this. Yeah, religion just straight up sucks. Press release.
It's just a waste of time.
Yeah, it's just totally a waste of time.
It wasn't even like, it's like, oh, it's antithetical to science, it's an impediment to this, or it's like women's rights. It's like, I want to sleep in, and I can't, because churches.
Outside of the context...
Because bells.
Outside of the context of a bulletin board, can you see any American Atheist or Humanist Association being this
clear?
Bold? In a press release and an open letter to a government official in the United States.
That is actually a fair point. That this is actually a much more direct thing. It's always couched in some sort of like public service.
Yeah.
That there's better things that we could be doing. You're absolutely right. Yeah. In fact, I just spun this as some kind of like... When we were just talking about this, I was like, oh yeah, we could be doing better things with the time. It's like, no. We could be doing nothing with that time, and it would be a better idea. They're not making an affirmative statement here. They're just saying, like, whatever it is you're doing, we would like that time back.
I like the sort of, like, there's just, like, a little bit of irony to me looking at this. Like, we would like a federal holiday put aside because religion is a waste of time.
There is sort of secret irony there.
Right.
We would like you to spend this whole day contemplating atheism.
Yeah.
Because religion is a waste of time.
Yeah. Jim Jeffries is the one who's been making the rounds recently with like a couple of clips, but he has a whole atheism thing that he does in his act.
Yeah.
But I like the fact that he frames atheism like basically anything that's done in the atheism is done in the name of atheism is in the name of nothing. Like no one's ever sawed some guy's head off and then looked dead into the camera and said, "In the name of nothing." Like that's his actual line.
Stop giving me ideas. Seriously, man.
It's like, yeah, so these guys want to be able to like stay home on a given day in the name of nothing.
In the name of nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm down with that.
I like it. But yeah. I mean, I'm not saying anything bad about like the FFRF or American Atheists. I think they're doing the job exactly right. Like
right.
I literally think they're doing exactly what they need to be doing, especially nowadays.
Right.
But the palate cleansing nature of this particular press release really struck me.
So I was saving this for another story that we have later on, but I think it's actually more apropos here.
Okay.
We talk a lot about the different ways that atheism as a minority movement tries to gain traction.
Yeah.
One of the things that I use as a litmus test to figure out whether or not something has finally become mainstream is, do people stop complaining when somebody from that movement goes on television and says something that's wrong?
Oh.
Like not like wrong to the group of the people.
Yeah.
Like whenever David Silverman goes on TV, there's a bunch of atheists that decide they're going to complain, as well as everybody else who complains whenever an atheist goes on television.
Sure.
But there's also a bunch of atheists that go on television, and I'm not singling out David Silverman, but in general, whenever an atheist goes on television, some bunch of atheists will say, like, they wasted an opportunity to da 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 blah. Mm. And they'll have some like nuanced approach to the way it should have been done. The reason why that's a problem is because there's scarcity in the voices of atheists.
Right.
And that scarcity results in people feeling like every opportunity needs to be squeezed to its core.
Right.
You don't see Catholics doing that. You don't see Christians doing that on television. You don't see a bunch of Christians going on television and then a bunch of other Christians are like, well, they should have really done it this way.
Well,
they just go on television and say that.
These are people who want atheism to be the Vulcan Science Academy.
They want it, right.
That's not really possible in the American context.
Right.
The fact of the matter is... these nuanced positions that a lot of people are talking about in comments require the participation and the agreement of everybody on this panel show or
right.
everybody in this press conference.
Right.
And very rarely do you get that. I mean, you just don't. It's not a thing that happens a lot of the time. So you have to go. Sometimes you have to go for the quick cuts. You have to go in for the jab. And you don't have a time to make a really good swing with all of the things that are lying around it. Can you tell I've done a little boxing?
You're like squirming around in your chair. The savate is coming.
And it's very hard to make a lot of these really nuanced arguments in the context of the American press.
And that's what I was saving up,
right.
Because before we were talking about something else, and everybody will know why we're talking about this later, but I really think as a movement, atheism, we need to learn how to ain't with all the colors of the wind.
Okay.
What?
How to ain't with all the colors of the wind.
Yes.
And it'll make sense later.
No, yeah. Planting seeds, are we?
Yes.
Okay.
The Idaho House Education Committee voted last week to remove references to climate change and human impact on the environment from revised educational science standards. 5 paragraphs of the proposed curricular standards on rising global temperatures and anthropogenic climate change were rejected by the committee with the approval of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Sherry Ibarra. Committee members argue that the standards did not teach both sides of the debate. House Committee member Scott Syme indicated that he only examined the standards closely after receiving many emails urging him to pass the standards. Syme suggested the pro-standards feedback were a coordinated effort from an unnamed organization.
Are you freaking serious?
In 2016, teams made up of the state's education department members and some of Idaho's most highly qualified science teachers drafted the standards on climate change after research and public hearings.
I'm just so mad.
We just did this nice little fun little globe-trotting kind of, hey, here's what's going on over there.
Right.
You know, saying nice things about it. Yeah. Humanist that, go died. Yeah.
I'm sure the people of the, sort of close to sea level island nation of Malta are really happy about the fact that climate change is going to continue apace, according to the people of Idaho, and sea level change.
Yeah.
Granted, the people of Idaho are fairly insulated against sea level change.
They're insulated against a lot of stuff.
They're not
insulated against global temperature rise as a farming state.
Yeah, they're not really insulated against the need for precipitation and things like that.
Right.
I mean, that's something that's definitely going to change. The only difference between, say, Boise and Phoenix is just the average amount of rainfall.
Mm-hmm. Because they're both high desert areas.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you cut that rainfall, you got a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Like Sheriff Joe. You don't want Sheriff Joe.
We're going to have the entire central area of North America relying on unsustainable desert agriculture while we run out of fresh water.
Sure. And,
we'll talk about more climate problems later.
Yeah, I was going to say. Right.
Yeah. Welcome to the Mad Max segment.
Let's contextualize this. This is an easier thing for them to do right now, given that you've got some federal, you've got some federal push on this.
You've got federal support for do it however you want to do it. Mm-hmm. States can make up whatever rules they want,
right.
And there are no standards.
Right.
You've got federal support for stepping away from having any oversight over the quality of education.
Right.
And if you decide you don't want to invest in quality, poor quality product ships.
Right.
A lot.
Yeah.
And that's basically what that's what Belle Biv DeVos actually wants.
You know what? No. Let's
you saw Saturday Night Live, didn't you?
I did. That was amazing.
Let's run this thing, right?
Okay.
Okay. So we dome off this area.
Mm-hmm.
And this is our control group, and we're going to see in their local climate what happens if this is the education we get. We could do this, like a 30-year running study.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to do this double blind. That gets really complicated into ethics about humanity and stuff. But let's just run this experiment. I am not a sociologist, but I have some ideas about how this might turn out.
Right.
And I don't think any of them are good. I'm going to be a little irresponsible and say that I have strong predictions going into the experiment. So I certainly can't be a researcher here. I think I know what's going to happen. But maybe if we ran an experiment like this, it would show the rest of the world some of the stuff that they need to see.
But that assumes that they actually believe in the notion of experimentation, and that they believe in the notion of comparing one thing that's been treated in one way to another thing that's been treated in another way.
They don't know they're in the dome.
you can believe in experimentation and testing and double blind stuff and all that,
mm-hmm,
as much as you like. If you really want to reject a premise, you can invent thousands of reasons, mm-hmm, why this particular premise doesn't stand up against any evidence you care to name. This is why we still have Michael B. This is why we still have, this is why we still have all of these people who are saying, climate change isn't a real thing, da 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 da, because they keep getting showed better and better evidence with better and better resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
So they're rejecting evidence for smaller and smaller and smaller reasons. And, this isn't a quantum thing. There's no bottom level.
Right.
because the point isn't that they don't believe in the evidence. They believe in the evidence. They just don't like the result.
Yeah. Right. And they just don't want to be bothered with it.
Right.
They kind of want there's an and this is Idaho. This is basically the entire Center Mountain States. People don't move to the Mountain States because they really love hanging out with other people. And they, you know, they're not all, you know, some of them can't make it all the way to Alaska, but the mentality's still there. Fair, they want to be away.
Yeah.
And so like Idaho, Montana, Colorado, a lot of these states, and Eastern Washington is part of that. And that's where this sort of libertarian movement that's aligned itself with conservatism in the United States has kind of grown up.
Where is the mountain state of the mountain states so that I can move there to be away from the people who don't want to be around
it's
people?
It's Mars. Move to Mars.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think we got to be careful when bringing up...
Upstate New York, in case you're wondering. Ithaca.
Ithaca.
Yeah.
Buffalo?
Yeah, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think we got to be a little careful when dragging libertarianism into this, because you've got the certain...
Because they're all guns.
Yeah. There's that, too. Just because we've gotten into politics doesn't mean I don't want to start painting people with the same brush.
That is fair.
I don't want to follow into the same traps that every other freaking political show has ever done.
That is entirely
fair. Especially when 2 weeks ago, sitting where you're sitting now, is someone who would completely defy your supposition here. Is definitely a climate change guy, because he understands what evidence is. But we can't ignore that for most of the United States, libertarian is actually a stand-in for Republican light.
Or right.
I'm too hip to be in the same party as John McCain.
Right.
Or something
that. I think that's a conversation for another time.
Possibly.
About small L versus big L libertarianism.
Right. Well, you know, we're talking about the political end of this because, well, we're going to go to a break. And when we come back... Dan is going to drop some verbiage down for science.
Heavy verbiage.
Heavy, heavy stuff in many sense of the word. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. Be back after the break.
Christ, way to make this.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Dorn, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio Versus the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Allegedly, soccer is a beautiful game.
It is when you know what's going on.
That's the problem. MLS is 20 years old, and people are still shocked to hear that there's an American Soccer League.
That's why you and I are talking about it. This is a discussion of American soccer for nerds and beginners. It's a good first step if a crippling soccer addiction is something that's missing from your life.
Join the club. Celebrate the 20th anniversary of MLS by actually following the season.
Hands-free football. New episodes every week at handsfreefootball.com.
I want to bring it back, but it's more than basic.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the third Thursday meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
No, that's entirely fair.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. And now, Dan Lombardo, with see what I almost did there? I want to say a moment for science, but then I realized that sounded like moment of science a little bit too much.
A little bit too much.
He's going to speak for science!
Today's For Science is about the ozone layer. This segment was inspired by a listener, Phil, from Michigan, who writes... Love the science segments. Thanks. I remember a few years ago, there was a lot of talk about a hole in the ozone layer, but lately I haven't heard much, and I think I even heard a rumor that it isn't a big deal anymore. Did the planet heal itself? Why was there a hole in the first place? Well, Phil, first let's talk a bit about what the ozone layer is and what it does for us. Oxygen makes up about 21% of Earth's atmosphere. The rest is made mostly of nitrogen, argon, and carbon dioxide, and varying amounts of water vapor and trace amounts of other gases, as well as some solid particulates like dust, pollen, and fungal spores. But of that 21% oxygen, most of it is what we call diatomic oxygen, or O2. Two oxygen atoms that bond together to form one very stable oxygen molecule, the one that we've evolved to breathe. However, not all atmospheric oxygen atoms are in couples. Some, instead of bonding with just one other atom, end up forming bonds with two, forming a triatomic oxygen molecule that we call ozone. Ozone is pretty cool. It's not very stable, it's a lovely shade of blue, and has a powerful smell that is, in my opinion, a little like a cross between bleach, a handful of pennies, and new electronics. As ozone is typically formed by either ultraviolet radiation or a large electrical discharge, it's easiest to smell after a lightning storm, since sniffing in-use arc welding equipment is not recommended. But back to the ultraviolet radiation. As you probably know, ultraviolet radiation can do serious damage to us humans, and it can damage and kill all kinds of things if they're exposed to enough of it. In fact, UV radiation is even used in medical sterilization because at short wavelengths, it can destroy the DNA or RNA present in bacteria, fungal spores, and viruses, causing them to die or become inactive. The sun puts out UV radiation continuously. But here on Earth, we're well protected from its damaging effects because about 20 to 30 kilometers up in our lower stratosphere, we find higher concentrations of ozone, the ozone layer. When ultraviolet radiation hits atmospheric oxygen, those dangerous high-energy photons of UV light are absorbed. But that energy has to go somewhere, and in this case, it goes into forming and breaking ozone molecules. An O2 molecule, struck by just the right frequency of UV, splits, sending two oxygen atoms careening off where they may encounter another O2 molecule, bond with it, and form ozone, only to be broken again by more incoming UV. This constant formation and breaking of ozone is called the ozone cycle, and absorbs 97 to 99% of the most dangerous UV energy coming towards Earth, long before it could burn our skin, kill our plants, degrade our plastics, halt fermentation in our beer, or give us cancer. The ozone layer protects us and makes life as we know it possible on Earth's surface. So what about that hole? That can't be good, right? Some gases make it to the lower stratosphere without being broken and can capture free oxygen atoms, preventing the formation of new ozone molecules. Some of these gases are nitric oxide, nitrous oxide, hydroxyl, and atomic chlorine and bromine. While all of these gases have natural sources, human activities emit a rather large amount. Particularly nasty are chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, and bromofluorocarbons, or BFCs. These large gaseous molecules cause a chain reaction that can prevent formation of up to 100,000 new ozone molecules per CFC or BFC molecule. CFCs were once used in a wide range of products, like aerosol sprays, and in many industries, like refrigeration and industrial solvents. In the late 1970s, it was discovered that the ozone layer was being depleted by these substances, and eventually, serious regulation began, via the Montreal Protocol of 1987, to phase out CFCs, the very first protocol ever in which every member of the United Nations actually agreed. The ozone hole isn't exactly a hole per se, but rather a dramatic thinning of the ozone layer, and it's been appearing over Antarctica every spring since the 1970s. While banning the use of CFCs from most industries and products has made great headway in restoring the Antarctic ozone layer, it's not quite that simple. While ozone is necessary to protect us from harmful UV radiation, the thin spot allowed a bit more heat to escape. As the ozone layer thickens back up, and coupled with the releases of CO2, methane, and other greenhouse gases as a result of human activities, Antarctica is warming faster than it otherwise would have. As Antarctic ice melts at continuously accelerating rates, global sea level rises. The reduction of reflective ice means more heat from sunlight is absorbed, melting the remaining ice even faster and further accelerating sea level rise. Of course, CFCs and BFCs weren't the only ozone depleters, and gases like nitric oxide and nitrous oxide are still being released into the atmosphere at unprecedented concentrations by human activities, such as burning coal. This continues to deplete the ozone layer globally. Even as our CO2 and methane greenhouse gas blanket thickens, So while the Earth warms and our oceans rise, we may be left with no protection from the deadly and carcinogenic UV radiation that would otherwise be blocked. I don't usually like to end the segment on a dark note, but this problem is very real, very serious, and poses a threat to all complex life on planet Earth. We have a clear choice in this matter, and it really is as simple as it appears. We either advance beyond the burning of fossil fuels, or we will most certainly perish, along with most of the precious life on this pale blue dot that we call Earth. It's a big universe, and there may well be other life out there somewhere. I, for one, would love to see it. However, developing the technology it'll take to find and visit that life on other worlds is going to take time that we do not have, unless we make sweeping cultural changes in the ways that we generate and use energy here on Earth. The universe is calling, but the clock is ticking.
If you have a question for science, you can give us a ring at 844-753-7842. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv, click on the big red button, and you'll get one of these really exhaustive answers from our science correspondent, Dan. Interestingly enough, it was once suggested that my personal fragrance is burning dust and ozone.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
There's a lot of old-timey radio equipment around here. Yeah. That lets off a fair amount of magic smoke when you mess with it.
Yes,
there's
it does.
A fair amount of sparking and arcing.
Yeah. If I'm working with modern technology, ozone is a sign that I've done something terribly wrong. If I'm working with old technology, ozone is a sign that I'm probably on the right track.
Right.
I don't know if that happens out here, but, I mean, ozone is, the effects ozone has on the environment is location dependent as well. I mean, if it's in that layer, it's doing us a, well, unless you want a cool Earth, it's doing us a good job. But like in Illinois, when you and I were kids, we'd have ozone alerts where we'd have to stay inside because the ozone was going to kill everybody.
Right, because it was just not enough coverage. And
It's wonderful for humans as long as it stays in the stratosphere. In the lower atmosphere, it's a real health concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happens if you, does it just take up all the space that would otherwise be taken up by O2? Or what's the effect of ozone? Well, I spend enough time with it, I should probably know that.
Because ozone is unstable, not only does it have the capacity to displace oxygen in your bloodstream, but because it's unstable and has that third oxygen that wants to sort of fly off and form bonds, it's carcinogenic.
Got it.
So I don't like to use buzzwords, but when we talk about free radicals, we're usually talking about the electrons flying off unstable, unpaired oxygens.
Right.
And that's what you will find in ozone once it starts reacting with anything else.
Oh, fair enough. Yikes.
Yeah, really.
Yikes indeed.
Well, that brings us to another associated question, which is ozone therapy? I know.
I like how the segment for science always transitions into the segment of woo.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's because anytime you have something good, somebody thinks, well, a whole lot of it's really good.
Right.
I mean, I feel that way about, meat.
Or spaghetti.
And that's got problems.
I feel like I'm always counting down to the pain to sigh and the after talk.
Yeah. there's a good side of it. Well, okay, good, quote unquote, is that if you have like a toxic smell or something like that. No, not toxic, but the smell of a toxic substance left over, say, in your car.
Right.
Ozone treatment will murder that smell pretty quickly.
Right. If not, so like if somebody when you smoke in a rental car, they do a whole thing. When you need to treat clothes that have been in a fire.
Right, because it apparently just tears through biological material pretty quick in high concentrations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
But the downside is it tears through biological material at a clip.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So people have just taken, ozone's good. Let's make a whole bunch of it and then breathe it.
Yeah, and I mean, let's not forget what was going on in the early 1900s with radium.
Right.
The idea was, this stuff glows. That must mean it's magical and good for you. So let's treat everybody with radium.
Right.
Well.
Or let's paint the dials, which requires
moistening
the paintbrushes with your mouth.
Oh, my God.
I'm not saying ozone treatments are going to cause you esophageal cancer, but I'm saying.
Or have your face fall off.
There's probably a reason that it hasn't been a part of our evolution to breathe ozone.
Well, continuing in the emotional roller coaster that is Ask an Atheist, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we are going to talk about, the response to what we were just talking about, which is the March for Science. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. A lot of fun stuff after the break.
I'm a certified ghost expert.
Wow, that's so credible.
Billy, your great-great-grandmother says she loves you, and to give me your lunch money.
Aw, anything for family. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled, week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I know.
Has Ngatwe Trust invaded your town? Are you tired of government officials who want to plaster Ngatwe Trust on taxpayer-owned property? Are you afraid because your local sheriff placed an In God We Trust decal on the patrol cars? We are here to help. The original motto project is for those who feel the separation of church and state is an important issue and should be honored regardless of your belief or lack thereof. Theists, non-theists, and all free thinkers are welcome. We need your support to show politicians that diversity exists within our nation, and their promotion of a monotheistic religion and push for theocracy will not be tolerated. Stand up and be heard. Join us at originalmotto.us.
Ask an Atheist may have gone on the road, but we're not making big bucks.
We still need to keep the lights on, and 95% of our costs are for airtime alone.
That's why we need your contributions.
If you've got something to advertise, consider Ask an Atheist in your ad budget.
Our listener Peggy said it best. Step up and contribute to keep secular voices on the air. For $5, you could have a latte or a moment of science.
Take on Peggy's challenge and contribute today.
For details, go to AskAnAtheist.tv or contribute directly via PayPal to PayPal@AskAnAtheist.tv.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. Joining us now is Miles Greb. He's a science communicator, a member of Seattle Atheists, a writer of two science-based comics, and organizer of Seattle's March for Science. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Fantastic. So, all right, March for Science. We're familiar with the other marches that have gone on since the inauguration. Tell us about the March for Science and its purpose.
Sure. So the March for Science kind of started organically online a few days after the whole threat of the EPA getting defunded and kind of gagged happened, and a lot of the national parks, they were told they weren't allowed to speak about climate change anymore.
Right.
And there was kind of like this thing in the air where people wanted to defend science, and originally it was going to be a march for scientists, but it kind of expanded over so many people were interested in to the March for Science.
Right. So it was going to start out as just a bunch of scientists, but it's grown beyond that.
Yeah, because...
That's good, because then I can go.
Yeah, definitely.
And me.
Yeah. An important part of the march, what we're trying to say, is that, you know, science doesn't belong to any political party. It doesn't belong to any moment in history or any group of people. You know, science is for everyone.
Right.
And so that's why we're trying to be inclusive to everybody that values the methodology of science.
That's interesting, because it's almost the inverse with maintaining the same truth value of what I've often said on the show, which is there is no political party in the United States that is pro science and will support science people, you know, or people who are interested in science for the if there's a cheap vote to do otherwise. And but this is the other side of that, is saying, is to try to create space that there's room to have a conversation about science in a nonpartisan way, where it doesn't have to be this party or that party. Everybody can participate.
There are people who care very deeply about science and scientists that do vote. And we would like that to be a larger issue. If you look at the statistics of what people vote on, you know, it's economy and stuff's always going to be up top.
Sure.
But science is way down that list.
Yeah.
You get a couple issues like climate change around at 14th, maybe, on like the Gallup poll. But science as an institution and as a process isn't on there.
Right.
And lots of people care about science. You know, it's kind of in the air right now. A lot of different science Facebook pages are popular. And, you know, Cosmos came back on the air, which is great. And so I think a lot of people say this is important, you know. Science used to be kind of our vision of the future. You know, it used to be the moon lander.
Right.
It used to be, this is what we're going to do in the future. You know, this is Star Trek. This is our inclusive way to look at the universe is through the scientific method. But now it's become more cynical. It's become the atom bomb in people's minds. And I think that the March for Science will bring people together to both talk about it and make it a powerful force politically again.
Do you think it's been significantly like a switch to cynicism, or is it just not a realization that there's a huge connect in how science gets done and what our government does about it?
Well, I think it can be both.
Okay.
I think that if you look at the way the public sees science, it's mostly through science fiction.
Right.
Right? That's kind of all been the way since the 60s. And the science fiction recently is quite cynical. It's not, you know, Star Trek anymore. It's, oh no, we messed up. The plague is out.
Yes.
And it's always the scientists who mess up.
Right.
Yeah. And it's always like the intrepid father of two.
Right.
Yeah. And
who somehow figures it out.
And in these films, you see scientists as kind of shut in people that don't understand kind of common problems, or they don't really have like a common logic. You know, they have like, oh, they're sophisticated, you know, college reasoning,
right,
and that gets them in trouble. But, you know, science is work. And scientists are working people.
Right.
You know, we're just the same as everybody else. And so that's a major thing we want this march to do. You know, there's never been a better time to learn about science or to get involved in science. You know, whatever problem science has had with including people of different groups, you know, this is a great moment to kind of break through that, because we're going to be on the street soon. So come and say hi.
Absolutely. And speaking of when you're on the street, the march is on April 22nd. Yep. Was that a intentionally chosen date, or is it just far enough ahead that everybody can go?
Looked a little both on that one, too.
Okay.
You know, so it is Earth Day, which is a great day.
Because,
climate change is one of the key issues right now, because the consensus on climate change is quite high, but the consensus of political will isn't.
Right.
And that needs to change.
Mm-hmm.
But also it gives us time to organize, because the March for Science is going to be a peaceful and positive march. And in order to get all the logistics settled, we're going to need some time. And so that's why we chose that date.
So I noticed that there's been some national press as well as some local press. And I know that there's going to be a movement. There's obviously going to be a march in Washington, D.C. But how did other cities just sort of like get involved in this? Usually marches are localized.
Sure. So the D.C. one is the founder.
Okay.
And then they said they were interested in satellite marches. You know, my personal life, I write a book mostly about the importance of science and kind of like spreading that out, you know, kind of like a Carl Sagan devotee.
Right.
And so when I saw this happening, I felt kind of like a moral obligation to, you know, get it going. And so since I'm pretty good at social media, I started the Facebook group, I got the Twitter, I tried to get in contact with HQ in DC and kind of like got us going as a satellite march. And then thankfully I've had a lot of really awesome people like Shireen and Teresa who kind of come to me, and we've kind of developed a leadership team. And so, all of the marches kind of did the same thing. It's pretty organic grassroots thing.
Cool.
It's basically just so many people cared about science a lot and wanted to get help. And then we're all kind of working together to get the logistics figured out.
And a related question, marches tend to have some kind of like, it's not just a group of people, right? There's like, you know, there's the signs and the chanting. But there's usually, in fact, we've seen this recently, there's been some visuals, right? So there were like the hats for, can we say?
Yeah.
They were pussy hats. They had pussy hats.
No, that's what they're called. It's press relevant. So First Amendment says go to town.
Go to town. Right. Yeah. Exactly. So so they had the pussy hats for for the women's marches, and that's sort of like a useful sort of visual tool to basically continue the movement and allow it to extend beyond the actual event. Are there any particular visual cues or symbology?
That's a very popular question in all the Facebook groups. You see the hats be brought up quite a bit. There's like the brain hats, which are probably the most popular people are doing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some people are going to wear a lab coat, some aren't, mostly because there's so many different kinds of scientists. You know, we don't really want a unified look so much, you know.
Right.
Like geologists wear their field gear. We're trying to be inclusive to all the different fields, so we don't have one thing, mostly because, you know, scientists are often free thinkers and the herding cats analogy always gets brought
there's
up.
You will all wear this uniform. It's like, no, that's why we're not part of big groups.
We just encourage people to come out and support science whatever way they feel is right for them. We just want to keep it positive and march for something, because like I said, science should be for everybody.
And this is actually connected to that as well, that like there's this idea, I think a prevailing notion of what scientists look like.
Right.
And I think it's a big part of this is, I think, driven by the standard sort of doctor that you see on a drug ad.
Right.
Right. It's like lab coat, generally white, generally a dude, you know, but that's not actually the definition of a scientist, to say nothing of the fact that that's not necessarily the prevailing sort of look of a scientist. So is that an aspect of this as well? Just kind of like broaden both like the gender, the ethnicity, and just sort of like the generalized definition of what science really is, as well as what scientists really are?
Definitely. Like I was saying, I don't want any group of people or your moment in history to feel like they've owned science. Because it's little bits of information gained throughout all cultures throughout time are why we know what we know. You know, like we had a little group get together. We went and watched Hidden Figures together, you know, and she's a working mother in the South, you know, working for NASA. And then she goes and back and finds like an old mathematic law that was written from a culture that's not her own. She uses that to help figure out the formula she needs to get man on the moon. So like everybody's inclusion throughout history kind of builds science. And we haven't done good enough in the West to like have that as a spirit of science. You know, it hasn't always been inclusive. I think the March for Science can really kind of push back against that because we can be so open. So like I said, any of these institutional problems that people have had getting into science, I can't cure them all, and the March for Science can't cure them all, but everybody's open now. There's a group of scientists you can go talk to, so hopefully that can help, you know, push back against that kind of prevailing biases that science has had. And we'll also, you'll get to see tons of different people that you normally don't see and think of as scientists at the March. You know, there'll be a diversity of both opinion, intellect, background, ideas, causes for the speakers and the marchers. So
while we're talking about opening things up and diversity of opinion and pretty much everything else, to bring it back a little bit to the wheelhouse of the show, has there been any religious pushback on this at all so far? Or
not that we've got. Religious people have asked to be included, and I've made it clear that they are. You know, I'm personally an atheist, but this is not an atheist march.
And that's, there's like, I have to walk a really tightrope, you know, a tightrope while I'm asking this question, because it's not like religious people don't care about science.
Yes, they do.
There's tons of religious people who care about science.
Yeah, as long as you care about the methodology of science and want to help support that, we invite you to the march.
Right.
We are going to seek out and include religious people who care about science. You know, I'm sure we have different opinions on certain things, but that's also true for non-religious people that don't believe in GMOs or vaccines, or don't accept the data on nuclear power as being efficient. You know, we have scientific opinions that disagree, and if that's totally fine, this isn't agreement march. You know, this is consensus for science march.
Right.
So
that's really important, is in a lot of these marches and a lot of things that I've participated in over my whole lifetime, is that factionalization has been a huge problem, and it tends to disintegrate movements almost all, sometimes almost before they get off the ground.
Yeah.
And I think the inclusivity here, especially in the modern context, which might have got, you know, that got this march off the ground in the first place, the fact that we can be inclusive in here, we don't have to agree on everything, but we have, but it's not the output that we're necessarily marching on, it's the process that's bringing us into place.
Definitely.
Seems to be an important component here.
And I want to stress that we're very inviting to conservatives and Republicans who feel like that they're not being represented scientifically, because there's tons of people who are pro-science that are conservative, that work in the tech sector, that, you know, the method gives them the tools to engineer their jobs. And so they have a stake in this too. And if they don't feel represented, we welcome them to come out and march for science as well.
Fantastic. So
this is actually, there's a piece about the types of problems that we try to solve with science that I think is actually, it kind of feeds into that stereotype of like the idea that we have of what scientists do and what scientists work on.
Right.
And so like the data collection that leads to the analysis that leads to determining which of the states you have to win in order to become the president of the United States, just to pick a problem out of a hat.
Right.
That's all science. Yeah. Like, that's all math. That's all data analysis. That's all empirical observation, followed by theorizing, followed by testing, followed by results, followed by drawing conclusions from those empirical
and
results.
And that math, for that particular question, can get pretty complex.
Like, right.
For example, the website that I follow for every presidential election since 2004.
538.
No, actually, no. Electoral vote.
Oh, right. No, you're right. Okay.
By Tannenbaum, of the Torvalds Tannenbaum debate, he publishes all of his methodology, all of the stuff that he does, and he's been pretty accurate. And where he's not accurate, he's tweaked his models, and he's like, oh, here's where I'm tweaking my models, and stuff like that. And it was all working great until November, where it all kind of fell over. And
well, yeah. Even 538, right? So right. They say there's a 20% chance that Trump can win, and so he wins, and then we say their model's wrong. But that doesn't demonstrate that. Right. You know, there was a 99.6 chance the Atlanta Falcons would win that football game, but we all saw it not it, work out that way.
It, and it dropped over
well,
the course
of the game.
Well,
I don't know that I want to bring fixed things into the universe of... Oh,
is this not a skeptic show? What's happening here?
Nah, joking. Not my sport. No, absolutely true. Is sometimes it's not the model that's wrong. However, I do think, if we're going to continue this conversation, that the fact this is the first time that the models and the reporting have been this off in my lifetime. And that's a notable thing.
Well, like so, perhaps, I mean, diverse outcomes don't necessarily mean that the model was wrong, right? I mean, like, it was 20% chance of winning and he wins.
Right.
Well, I think that what you just said is exactly right, that this was an unusual outcome.
An unusual outcome, regardless. But don't necessarily. It was
significant.
But it may not necessarily be the model that's broken. It could be other. It could be data collection. It could be there are a lot of things that could have been broken here that create this result.
Speaking on data, another reason why the March for Science is important is we pay for that climate change data.
Right.
We pay for all kinds of scientific information, and if the government's going to keep it from us, it is not giving us what we paid for, and that's an issue everybody should care about.
Sure.
I definitely echo that. And I'm calling back the fact that the start of the march and the start of the movement really was this sudden silencing of the output of scientific information that's public domain information by a number of public agencies. So the fact that the data itself is actually at risk.
Yeah.
Like, there's been an entire movement to just, like, literally, like, jam from the APA with hard drives in hopes of putting it somewhere else so that it doesn't actually get lost.
Yeah, it's something I've been wanting to talk about for a bit, but the finding data on that is hard, and I kind of wonder why.
Yeah, right.
I think that actually it's an incredibly important point that, this data that we're marching about that's being removed is stuff that we already own. Mm-hmm. We've already paid for it.
Right.
That's huge.
Right.
So I think we can imagine how marches are going to go at Washington, D.C., because you got to hit all the important points in Washington, D.C. in order to make the march into a political march.
Sure.
How do you envision the march going, working out in the confines of Seattle?
Sure. So we're still working out logistics and path route and everything, right?
Okay.
But we really want to focus on all the important scientists and scientific discoveries that happened in Washington. You know, we have a lot of different people working in marine biology or information that ends up going to the tech sector. And all these people make the city work. You know,
right.
They keep it beautiful. They keep it functioning. And we want to highlight those people.
Mm-hmm.
We want to say that, like, Seattle is a science city.
Yeah.
And that it's not just the scientists. It's everybody. The whole process to do science takes a lot of people. And so we just want to really engage everyone in that as much as we can.
That's a good point. I mean, you say Seattle, people think Amazon, people think Microsoft, but they completely ignore... That completely ignores the enormous amount of research that happens here.
Right. To say nothing of Boeing.
Like, nothing of Boeing.
Yeah, Boeing. Yeah. Boeing is a company in the business of taking a thing that weighs like a couple hundred tons and throwing it into the air and it stays there. Like, that's novel.
Yeah, that's also...
Like, that doesn't intuitively seem like it should work.
Yeah, and I'm not to discredit that in any meaningful way, but there's a lot of pure research that happens in Washington State that we just don't hear about because it's pure research, so it doesn't make it to the, half-hour news.
I see what you're saying, right.
A lot of medical research.
So we pay attention to Microsoft and Amazon, but we don't pay attention to the Fred Hutch.
Right.
Right.
But that's all that medical research, that's labor. You know, these are hardworking people, and they don't get seen that way, my father was a logger, and those people work hard, and everyone gives them credit for all their sweat and everything. But scientists, people don't see them like that. But they're going over these studies all day, and sometimes they're negative studies. And nobody cares about them. There's no flashy headline on "I effing love science" about what they did. But these are the building blocks that make everything work. They're laying the foundation to the thing that may save your father's life, or just may make the world better or expand our life expectancies, like science has been doing for decades. And these people should be honored. And so if March for Science can make them, get their moment, then we've done something good.
I really like to bring it back to the sort of the form of the march itself and where people are going to go. I think it's a huge signal about what this march is about, that the march itself is going to places, that the actual physical putting one foot in front of the other to do this march has an educational component to it because you're taking them to places where the research is happening, where the science is happening, here in Seattle. or there in Seattle.
We would like to involve the Science Center in some way.
Yeah.
But I can't confirm that at this time.
Sure.
But, you know, like, I went there as a child, and it was really inspirational to me. And I definitely would like to hopefully share that experience I had with any kids that come to the march, because we're trying to be as family friendly as we can. Plus, I mean, that's where the World's Fair was, right? And the Space Needle seems retro, but that, like I said, that was back when we thought science was going to build our better, brighter future.
Right.
And in many ways it has, but we don't invest in it as much as we used to. Like I said, life expectancies are up, right? Standard of living is up across the world. We know more. We've gone farther. We can see images of our planets and our solar system that we could never see before. And they inspire this awe and this power in us. And I think we need to keep doing that. You know, we don't need to waste time sectioning each other off.
It's interesting you bring up the optimism of the World's Fair, because the World's Fairs have always been sort of scientific road shows, essentially, right? So they were like, you know, it's like, let's show off everything that we think we can do based on the things that we know how to do right now. And then let's paint a picture of the future based on the continuation of that development, of that learning, and the institutionalization of that into industry and into manufacturing and into basically installing that kind of knowledge into personal lives.
Definitely.
And that... It's interesting that if you look at the actual numbers, again, look at the data, right? We are actually better off on any of a number of metrics than we were in the 1950s when the World's Fairs were a thing. But the optimism has dialed back. The willingness to pay attention to that data in order to paint that future, the willingness to use that data instead of using, for lack of a better word, the current trope of alternative facts,
right?
To paint that future, I think that's the thing that I keep coming back to in terms of like what I'm really excited about with the March for Science.
Well, one thing no one predicted in those retro sci-fi things was the internet. You know, it wasn't there. So the thing that the internet does is it hyper-focuses on our problems, which isn't always bad. Because it gets people concerned in things that they wouldn't know about, right? And it's important to have that, because warnings are important. But it's also important to have goals. And I think sometimes we forget about that because of all the things we can see now because of the internet.
You know, we get everybody together. We broadcast the crap out of this. We make it a turning point for discussion of science within the United States.
Mm-hmm.
What's the path forward for this organization after this unique event ends?
Sure. So I would like to have us as a group continue to do things, even if it's just getting people to be in touch with their scientists, you know, having people go to like the Brigham Museum or Seattle Science Center, like with some scientists, and they can take their kids, days like that. Or we can continue to try to be like a touchstone for science issues, so we can advise, you know, this is the science on this political issue or not. Because if the group has some kind of equity, I think that we could possibly do that. There's lots of ways forward for the group, which will have to be decided by more people than just myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important that if we take this steam and we use it to move the wheels of science in America, both in the march and forward, then it'll be an impactful thing.
Fantastic.
And on an engineering metaphor, I always say.
So, in addition to this, I don't want to get you out of here without mentioning this at all. It says you write two science-based comic books. Can you briefly tell us about
them? Sure, yeah. I'm here for the march, but you know, I'll give this bill since it's on topic.
Please.
So my first one was After the Gold Rush, which is like a return to optimistic science fiction. It's based in hard science, and so everything in there is peer-reviewed. I even have a section in the back. If like I mess anything up, you can write it and correct us. It follows Scout. She's the last scientist, and she returns to Earth for the first time, and she finds it a vast wilderness. And it's kind of about her exploring what's going on there. And that one has two books out now, and the third one is in the works.
And so
it's kind of the first openly atheist comic as well. Okay. I mean, I'm not trying to be heavy-handed with it. I'm just being very clear that it's set in our universe, and so, you know, there's no God.
Subtle.
Well, I'll be laughing about that one.
Yeah, and it's kind of sneaks up on you.
Yeah, and I wanted to dispel a lot of tropes that skeptics and atheists and scientists have in that book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I watched Prometheus, and my eyes almost fell out of my head because I rolled them so damn much.
Oh yeah.
And so I wanted to, like, there's the scene in that film where they like take off their helmets even though they're scientists and touch the air. You know, Scout, like, she sees there's chlorophyll. she knows, like, okay, so, you know, there's probably plant life that I'm aware of, so there's probably oxygen. I see soul, so I'm probably, this is probably Earth. You know, it's a reasonable induction that this is Earth, so I can take off my helmet. She's not just like, oh, yeah, take off my helmet, get killed by an alien monster.
Right.
And also there's this thing called, like, the doctor scientist that you see a lot, where if somebody's, like, good at science, they know everything about medicine, they know everything about, you sure. know, atomic theory.
The halo effect, where yeah. it's just like, yes, right. Yeah, I think we have one of those running HUD now.
Yeah, Scout's a biologist and a chemist, and that's what she knows about. You know, she doesn't know about everything else, so I wanted mm-hmm. to kind of focus on that. And then my next one is Clovis, which is a prehistorical fiction. Mm-hmm. It's set in the Pleistocene era, and it follows the kind of fictional historical person of the mother of Anzac. Anzac was a Clovis person, who were some of the earliest Native Americans. She buries her son, who is Anzac, who's a real historical person, and then she sees a plume of smoke, and hoping that's some kind of sign, she follows him across the wilderness. And we use it as a way to kind of show what America looked like in the Pleistocene era and show the awesome megafauna, like Megatherium, mm-hmm. or the horses and camels we had back in North America. You know, things that people don't really think about.
Right.
Because, you know, everyone looks at dinosaurs, and that's cool. Dinosaurs are awesome. But there were interesting people that lived back then, which I said have the same hardware as us. You know, we're evolutionary, the same sure. as they are. And I just wanted to kind of tell their story a little bit.
So if people want to participate in the march or know what's going on with the march, where would I send them?
Yeah, so you should definitely go to our Facebook, just March for Science/Seattle. Mm-hmm. We also have an event page, or it's SciSeattleMarch is the Twitter. You can go to this things, or you can just look for me, Miles Greb. You'll find me on the internet, and I'll get you in touch with the
Fantastic. March. Miles Greb is a science communicator, a member of Seattle Atheists, and a writer of two science-based comics, and an organizer for Seattle's March for Science. You have to come back. We need to talk more about your comic
book. Oh, my God, yes.
All right. There are so many people who participate in the show who would have so many questions for you and love to talk about
sure,
it.
Sure, well, I left a few.
Okay,
you can
great.
Read them. Let me know if you find any flaws in them.
Yeah.
And we can talk about
And
that.
Also, apparently, we both have to talk about Dune.
Okay, yeah.
Yes.
We're both...
right.
We're both... Well... It's weird because I don't talk about it. I'm kind of monastic in my science fiction consumption,
sure.
so it's like it's gonna be weird. So many words I've never actually pronounced out loud before that it's gonna be great.
Oh, you've never actually done that? That's true.
Yeah. yeah.
Like, is it Kwisatz-Haderach or Kwisatz-Haderach?
It's Kwisatz-Haderach.
Yeah.
Right. here lies a toppled god. His fall was not a small one. We did but build a pedestal, a narrow and a tall one.
That's the beneath Lilac. Indeed, this is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC. I pronounced it correctly, yay. 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we said we were going to do it.
We're doing it.
It's time for politics.
My name is Jonathan Ariola of TDTF Pod. The more voices you hear, the more we observe and feel, the more we learn about the other facets of this complex and wondrous beast that is humanism and free thought. Join me on the science-loving journey through topics like justice, murder, family, diligence, taste, history, society, race, boob jobs, law, addiction, video games, fear, sacrifice, children. Wait, not sacrificing children. That's not what I meant. Bring the popcorn and watch me break down the issues too deep, too fast. Join me at TDTF Pod. I'm Jonathan Ariola. Talk to you soon.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. So, 2 weeks ago, last time I was on the air, I asked you guys how you felt about the show's turn to politics and a little bit more of a generalist discussion of the world we find ourselves in the... in the Trump administration.
I forget.
This is the political section, so I'll name him.
he who shall not be
named. Yeah, and boy, did I get a response. Let's go over some of them. Terry from the internet writes, I'm enjoying the show's break from atheism and skepticism. We need to talk about Donald. Pat from the internet also writes, DeVos, possible repeal of the Johnson Amendment. I think these entirely intersect between the Cheeto in chief and atheism. Keep up the good work. Murphy from the internet writes, if it's any consolation, I didn't really pay deep attention to the show until you guys started talking about all the things in life that are around and tangent to being an atheist. That turned you, for me, from representatives and talking point vectors into humans whom I can relate. I am much more comfortable with the podcast and I listen more closely because, in addition to the news stories and information, I find out about who you are, which helps me judge the information better. Also, you won my heart with the LARPing as a baseball fan line. Thanks a lot. And this is, thank you guys, all of this. I got one more email, but this, after getting that email from Randy, and Randy's position on that, you know, he's listening to the show for a very specific purpose. He listens to a lot of podcasts. And, you know, I understood his position. I just was worried that so many people were going to be in that position. I just felt incapable of doing the show that Randy wanted, given where we were. Ah, Bethany from Chicago writes, do keep talking about politics. As one of an agnostic persuasion, I think it's important that our community discusses all aspects of our lives and how we connect and interact with them. Politics, especially in the current situation, is part of that in deep, meaningful, and often threatening ways. If our community doesn't engage and talk about politics, we won't be represented in politics. I appreciate the fact that there is side talk, personal talk, and funny talk. It helps the weighty issues go down more easily. I particularly appreciate when not everyone behind the mic agrees, but everybody engages with integrity and thoughtful dialogue. Side note, I'm currently living in Chicago, but I used to live across the Puget Sound from Seattle and went to Tacoma frequently. You give me a taste of home each week. I've gotten other family members hooked. Wow, thank you, Bethany.
Chicago and Tacoma.
Yeah, Bethany, the opposite of me.
the anti-Sam.
Yeah, jeez. Yeah, I was just in Chicago last month. the thing about Bethany's comment is that's exactly what we're trying to go for.
Yeah.
Well, I think for us, it's become that atheism and free thought have become more. I think they've become more relevant to us because there's this unique. We live in this interesting time where there's an application of it, and so it's an opportunity to get non-abstract about it, to get concrete, to get real, if you will, about what are the actual implications in politics, in schools, and in the world. Of being an atheist. I think the moving away from the abstraction and at least, you know, for at least part of the show, and I know the beginning of it is going to be much more of the show.
Right.
Who knows what the end game is or like what is coming up next. But I think the transition was a little bit of an opening of floodgates. I can completely understand people listening to the show being like, it was a 90-minute show, and it was like mostly politics. right. But I mean, those same people should have been like, it was a 90-minute show, and it was mostly the Cubs. So, I think you have to decide. I mean, if there are people who just don't want to listen to politics, and that's a completely legit thing. Like, our clock radio in the morning, pops off at 6:15, and it used to pop off with NPR, which meant from 6:15 to about 6:40 or so, we would have like really weird dreams about like congressional hearings.
Yeah.
And like and the Russians invading and Red Dawn and that's what was like infusing our final sort of REM sleep. And that was not great. And so we decided we were gonna listen to like local community radio for a while. And so the clock radio next to my bed has been tuned to like KEXP for about 3 weeks.
Not a bad choice.
Because it's hard.
Yeah.
And that was actually, that worked really well for the first 4 days. And then Leonard Cohen died.
Oh.
And then like KBCO, and then it went to KBCO in Colorado.
Right.
For a little bit. Another community radio station.
Right.
That my wife is fond of. And so, but I think still that it's become much more applicable to talk about free thought, to talk about atheism, to talk about, well, what does it actually mean? What are we actually needing to do about it? The transition to action requires a lot of conversation. And so I think it's super relevant. I'm really glad that everybody's speaking up about it, because I know, Sam, you and I have had a bunch of conversations where you're like, I don't know. It seems natural. It seems like it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But
I wish you guys could sit in on the bar conversations I've been having over the last few months over just me just... I'm not like going to everybody I know and say, tell me what to do. It's just sometimes it's like, I think I'm not doing this. Or some people say see the pensive look on my face and they go, you're thinking about the show, aren't you? And, you know, and it's like, Sam, your politics is what you should be doing, et cetera, et cetera. There's the push by some people to say I should just do a political show that was based off of some ideas I had 10 years ago at this point.
Right.
But I still like this, and I still find this find what Ask an Atheist was originally designed for incredibly meaningful. And I think as an indicator of its meaningfulness, our last email on this subject comes to us from Nick from the internet, who writes, "Hi, Sam. I wanted to let you know that I enjoy the show and its latest iteration as much as I have enjoyed it in the past. I first heard your show when my friend Three Ninjas was on the show as a musician. This would have been just a year after I realized that I had been an atheist for some time, but unable to admit it to myself. I was working as a music director at a Southern Baptist church, and this was around the same time the Dennett Lascola study on pastors who were secretly atheists, which led to the founding of the Clergy Project, began making the rounds. The president of one of the SBC's seminaries wrote about it, stating how terrible it is that people like those in the study exist and how they should feel ashamed. My pastor wrote a short thing from the same perspective in the church newsletter. Reading it was the most eye-opening moment I'd had in a long time. I realized I was one of those secret atheists working in the church. When I did start listening to podcasts regularly to stay sane while working in a very conservative church with a super fundamentalist pastor, who actually believes that eagles have talons and sharp, strong beaks to crack open coconuts since no animals ate flesh prior to the flood, your show was one of the first I subscribed to. The change from being mostly about atheism to being a mixture of atheism and social justice coverage is one that mirrored my own journey. These days, now free of the church, I think very little about religious belief, as little as one living in the Deep South with a Southern Baptist pastor for a father can do, and much more about the issues affecting those with less privilege than I. I have embraced humanism, feminism, and LGBTQ rights as causes I care about, along with the separation of church and state, so I enjoy hearing these things covered. I also love the science segments."
Aww.
"So basically, this is a long email to say I'm still listening. I enjoy the content and keep doing what you're doing. I feel the name of your show, Ask an Atheist, is still apt as you're still an atheist and it still does informed and is informed by the other aspects of your life. I did consider fast-forwarding through some of the baseball talk in that one episode, but I stuck with it."
So, apart from your occasional forays into alternative faiths,
right?
He's all good.
Yeah.
So,
this is a great letter. I'm sorry, Nick. You're awesome.
So, shall we get into this week in the best words?
Oh boy.
Which is okay. So, federal agent courts uphold district court's ruling on an executive 7-country travel bans, allowing immigration and travel to continue. So this is basically the end of the Muslim ban. He's been saying on Twitter and other places that he's going to come up with a complete new one. Is that where we are right now?
Yeah, his basic thing was like, "Oh, well, I'll just go ahead and put together a new one, or I'll put together a different one, or I'll see you in court." Again, we don't actually know what his plan is.
Yeah.
We don't know anything. We just know what he managed to
cram. We assume there is a plan.
Why?
Yeah.
There has not been 1-4.
No.
I mean, we don't actually know.
It seems to be sort of the shotgun strategy here.
Right.
There's no actual focus. There's no actual plan here. It's just keep throwing stuff at the wall until something sticks. If you throw enough stupid ideas out there, one of them's bound to make it through.
Yeah. So, like, remember like the political sideline of the last 8 years was like, "Oh, the Republicans are bored. How do I know? Because they're voting to repeal Obamacare again."
Right.
You know, like, they were like, I can't remember at last count. I stopped counting at 37 repeals of attempts to repeal Obama.
Yeah, I think it was in the high 40s by the time they were done.
But it's that. It's just like, we're just going to keep trying. We're just going to keep doing stuff. We're just going to keep doing stuff. And we're going to figure out what works.
Yeah.
And what works, I think that's the question we want to ask. The piece I keep coming back to is whenever Trump is talking about something, whenever he's talking about something on Twitter, whenever he's talking about something in a sort of like bombastic and really
see you in court, perhaps
attention grabby kind of way, watch the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
He's a professional con artist. Watch the other hand.
Is he though? He's a bad professional con artist. No, how much stuff has he been caught out on?
Not enough. Not enough that he hasn't been successful.
Hmm.
I mean, he's sufficiently insulated from consequences by money.
Right. But money doesn't necessarily, in the context of being a successful con man, money doesn't necessarily equal, the insulation of money does not actually equate to success. It might just hide failure. That's fair. I guess that brings in the question, does
No.
Hiding fail here.
You're not going to get any argument from me. I worked for Microsoft.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Oh.
I'm
not sure you have to be good at being a con artist to succeed at being a con artist.
You know, there's an elephant in the room, and I think I'm going to end on this because we're already, this part of the show is already longer than the entire rest of the show. is I nearly walked away from the atheism community this month. Last month. I nearly just said, you know what? Screw you guys. I'm going home.
Sorry. I just see you as Cartman doing that. There's just the long hair, but other than that, just like a paper dude.
Over this Muslim ban.
Over the Muslim ban?
Over the Muslim ban. Just the number of people who have been saying, well, it gets rid of the terrorists, doesn't it? I have been shocked at the number of Muslim ban apologists in my Facebook feed in the last month. And the weird thing is I've been talking this over with Becky and with other people, and apparently I'm the only person who can see it. They might just be in my head, or maybe I've just been attracting the really wrong kind of Facebook friend for the last ever. But there's a lot of people saying, well, Islam is the religion of terrorism, and these are Muslim nations. Does it not make sense for us to ban them? And like, dude, do you even think?
Islam happens to also be the religion of neuroscience and cardiology.
Yeah,
algebra.
The religion of architecture.
Right.
And infrastructure.
A person's religion actually has a whole lot to do with what they do in their life, unless they're specifically a priest or an imam or a clergy of some kind. When you're banning people based on the nation they were born,
you know, I don't even want to appeal to these people's better nature because I'm not even sure they got one.
Okay, well, you may be right on that. I'm not interested in appealing to their better nature, but rather speaking to those who might be a little undecided or, you know, just like the sounds of our voices. When you're throwing out a ban on country of birth based on the religion of that country, you're not just excluding maybe some radical Islamists or all Islamists. You're excluding everyone from that country.
That's all that's been in the news, and that doesn't seem to be affecting them. I mean, this is an incredibly compelling social story for people like you and me, who are humanists.
Yeah.
But for people who may not necessarily be, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. All they see is that Islam is according to the press and other places that Islam is the religion of terrorism. Mm-hmm. So if you ban Muslims, you ban terrorism. And if this were effective, why are all the terrorist organizations really into this ban?
Right.
Why are they cheering this?
It's just like the war on drugs, right?
Right. So it's like we've had this strategy that's been going on for so long, and it's created this sort of atmosphere where people feel like they have so little voice that they got to blow some people up. So we got this problem. Now it's a problem. Now it's a pandemic, and it's all coming from one place, and they've got these concerns, and these concerns are based on our behavior. So our response to this is to continue our behaviors just as we've been doing before until they're all dead? Until what is your end game here? If this Muslim ban is actually, like, you think it's going to end or cut down on terrorism here or abroad, what is your end game? Where does this go? I mean, is it just me that are seeing a lot of these defenders of the Muslim ban in the atheism community? I mean, are other people seeing this? And, you know, I when I see people talk about this, a lot of these people are in Europe, but an increasing number of them are in the United States, talking about, you know, if you bring Islam here, you'll bring terrorism, completely ignoring all the other terrorism that's been happening. Right.
Completely ignoring the Muslims who are already here.
Yeah, right. Completely ignoring the Muslims who are already here.
Who are feeling more and more marginalized.
And who are, by the way, like the Muslims in the United States, because they're in the United States, they're the most well-armed Muslims in the world. I mean, seriously.
To
just go to the store and buy an AK-47.
To my point, though, is that all of these arguments about why we shouldn't bring refugees here because they'll change the culture or they're potentially violent, it stops being a And I think this is where the Islamophobia thing comes in, where it actually starts becoming Islamophobia rather than just concern about a kind of violent religion. Because it is kind of a... If you're asking me if Islam is a violent religion, my answer is going to be yes.
Because most religions have
Because
violence.
Religions are violent.
Right.
But when you start forming these, all of these, sort of these exceptionalist arguments specifically about Islam and just ignoring the data in front of you, it starts looking like you're defending the status quo. And as an atheist, why the hell are you defending the status quo? The status quo sucks for you.
The status is not quo.
Right.
<Yeah. laughs>
It is so not quo.
Why is this a thing that you're defending? And so there's this, the two major questions I've been wanting to ask people is, why are you defending the status quo? What cult, as an atheist, as an active atheist in the United States, why does this status quo attract you when you are basically voiceless? And two, if you're going to kick people out of the country and let them die elsewhere, what's your end game for solving these problems? Because keeping them out of the country hasn't solved the problem yet, hasn't solved the problem in, you know, the 10,000 years that we've been doing this human civilization thing. What's your end game? What does it look like?
There's a short-termism to the conversations that we're having because, I mean, as we saw, right? So what's Trump's response to three judges? Well, many, many judges, but like mainly, like most recently, the three appellate court judges striking down the ban, striking down the executive order. Well, I'll just do a new one. So there is no end game. The end game is I told everybody I would create a ban. I got to create a ban. If the courts knock down my ban, I'll make a new ban.
I'm not expecting an end game from him because obviously the end game for him, it's a short-term thing. This is a business proposition.
Right. The end game for him is more money for the Trump
and a country frightened by terrorism gets him the kind of environment that he wants to get whatever he needs done.
Right.
I'm not looking from the administration for a particular end game to terrorism because they're into this. They love this stuff. They got a big stiffy about it. But the people, specifically the people who might listen to this show, who identify as an atheist, who I've been talking to on social media, or at least listening to on social media for the last 3 weeks, I want to know what their end game is. People who are not inside of the reality distortion field that surrounds the White House right now, why are they in support of this?
I couldn't possibly tell
you. I'm certainly not looking to you for the answer.
But you and I have both had, you and I both tried to steward the gun control conversation on the Seattle Atheist Forum every quarter.
Yeah.
Before finally saying, look, is there another side to this? Is there a pro-atheism and anti-atheism discussion to be had about gun control? No.
Nope.
Then stuff it.
We're done.
Not here.
Yeah.
So you and I have had this sort of like, so you and I are familiar with the places where atheism is comorbid with other stuff.
Right.
I don't have an answer for you. I'm really good at this sort of like alt fiction thing.
Sure.
I don't have it. I have no idea like how atheists could align themselves. I mean, I can understand how they might do it individually. Like I'm gesturing at Dan because Dan had a fantastic counter argument to my evolution tirade earlier. But yeah, there are people living in bad faith all the time. There are people living in like a cognitive dysfunction or a cognitive disconnect all the time. But this is hard. This is genuinely hard for me to understand. I wish I could come up with one.
I suspect the people who listened, the people who might have listened to this show who were in favor of the Muslim ban, they're all gone now. But we have to look outside of us if we want to get an answer to this.
Is there an answer? I mean, do we want to?
I think there has
to. Do we want to ask?
I am asking. Well, that is what. No, Ron John.
Them.
That is what I am asking.
Okay.
I am asking this thing. If you're in favor of the Muslim ban and you identify as an atheist or as a humanist, I want to know what your end game is. What does the solution to our current problems look like? What do you have for me that has this Muslim ban in place that fixes our problems? And that, please answer that question for me. This is Ask an Atheist. Our phone number is 844-753-7842. Our email is questions@askanatheist.tv. Our Twitter is askanatheistwa. See you guys next week.